So our panel is made up of John Kiriko,
Kirchero,
who is the director principal of Willits Charter School, grades 6 through 12. And I'm torn about reading your bio.
I
want to say that in seeing his background, spending 26 years in Northern California and 15 years here in Willits, playing an incredible number of roles, intervention specialist, crisis counselor, substance abuse counselor for Mendocino County Health and Human Services, private contractor with the county and the juvenile probation system, and this is his second year as principal director of Willits Charter School, and relocating in July. So we need to get everything out of him we possibly can in the next few months and in this conversation today. And looking forward to hearing more from you.
Thank you.
And then we have Robin, in my order, Robin Edwards, who is the Education, Disabilities, and Mental Health Manager from MCO Head Start. And she has a nearly 20-year career in the field of early education. Hard to believe. She's been trained. The number of degrees she has trainings is definitely a tongue twister. Triple P, C, S, E, F, E, L, P, I, T, C, different certifications. And
lots of acronyms.
Many acronyms. And she's been with NCO Head Start for 6 years, and we're going to hear a lot more from her about that background. And now she is in the position she's currently serving is the Education, Disabilities, and Mental Health Manager position, which is, we'll hear much more about. And then we have Nika Aguirre, who's an adjunct history professor at Mendocino Community College, who has been in Willits now for a little over a year.
Mm-hmm.
And she teaches both part-time at the college and volunteers at the County Museum in the education programs and the digital history program. She teaches history here at the college. So I think we shouldn't let you off the hook with your three adjectives to start. We'd love to hear both your three adjectives and then a little bit about your work, the mission of your organization, who you work for, and what, how you define your work. Either of you can start.
Okay. three words. I like learner, which a lot of people said. I'm definitely a reader, and I talk way too much. as far as my work, like she said, I'm an adjunct history professor, so I'm on the ground actually teaching. For the most part, I'm not as involved in the organizational system, but I do get to do some things like we have what are called student learning objectives, which look at whether we're teaching things appropriately and whether the students are receiving them. And if they're not, if we have this objective, we want our students to learn it, and we find that when we test them on it, they're not getting it, what do we do to change it? So we get to be involved in helping to develop and alter those, which is fun. As far as the mission of the organization, community college to me is kind of says it all. It's really involved in the community, because when you think of a university, universities, you know, they can anchor communities, they can do things, but for the community college, it's not just about you come here, we give you a degree if you do good. We're interested in helping you if maybe you're behind and you're not really ready to, go to a university yet. Or if I've had a lot of students either who were high school students who just wanted to kind of get ahead, I had a gentleman in my class last semester who was an older gentleman who said, I read this book and I wanted to know more about it, and I'm retired and I decided to take a class on it. So lifelong learning. And then also people who want to get maybe a certificate to do a career that doesn't necessarily take a four-year degree, or who want to, get their four-year degree but want to do it a little bit less expensively and maybe get a little more personal attention, because that's one of the nice things about community college. Classroom sizes tend to be smaller than, say, a university. So they might start with us and then transfer eventually. The college itself says that their mission is to deal with students at all levels, intellectual or students who come from different diverse backgrounds, economic issues, different cultures, different intellectual levels, and help them with whatever they want to do, whatever they want to accomplish. I guess I talk too much.
No, not at all. And I love that because, I mean, I started at community college, and it's funny, you know, I'm also a parent, I guess, which would be one of my words I would describe myself with. The one would be curious and enthusiastic. But, you know, it's a big part of our communities these days. So the program I work for is NCO Head Start, and this is the second Head Start program that I've been fortunate enough to work with. And I feel really lucky in my career that I found them, because originally I got into early education at a really young age, and it was my fallback career. And then what I was really interested in was social work. But as I got more and more educated, I found out that it really wasn't social work in general. It was social work really directed towards supporting families with young children. And I didn't know a lot about Head Start. And I found a major. I went to the University of Hawaii, and they had a program called Family Resources, which is just a perfect match for what we do in Head Start. And it's actually an early education setting where we truly believe that, you know, you cannot isolate the child from their families, that there's a partnership between what we do and how we work with parents, and then also how we work with parents in integrating them and supporting them within the community. And the goal of our program is to support children in reaching their highest potential. And I see more and more that statement being altered to say supporting children and their families in reaching their highest potential. It's a big part of what we do. And in my current position, you know, in early education, I mean, I've done so many different things. I've started as a student, an aide, a teacher, an associate teacher. I've been a site supervisor. I've been a specialist. And now recently I took on a management position. And I find myself spending less and less time, of course, with the children. And most of my work gets done by either supporting the staff that work directly with the children and families. And a lot more of it gets done by doing paperwork than I ever thought possible. And that math teacher that said, no, you're going to need to know how to do word problems was right.
Damn it.
But, you know, it's fun, too, you know, and it's exciting because on the other end, I get to see some of the new stuff that's coming down, and I get to do the problem solving of how are we going to make this information accessible to the people that are actually going to have to use it and help them implement it. So,
and can you talk a little bit about the main programs that Early Head Start offers?
Early Head Start. So, in my job, I oversee the education, the disabilities, and the mental health service areas. There's also nutrition, there's also health, there's also family services. So, and I oversee them for Early Head Start, which covers prenatal all the way up to 3 years old, and Head Start, which is 3 to 5. So it's those three service areas combined, which is not all Head Starts arrange their program in that way. But it helps with the I see it as really helping with a kind of the holistic way of those three, how those three things are integrated. But really all the other things could fall under those three service areas as well.
And who are your primary clients?
Our primary clients, our clients are families with children ages 0 to 5. And with Head Start, though, we are servicing. So we do have criteria for eligibility, and one of the main criteria is income eligibility. We are trying to serve children in our community or families with children that are considered at risk, which does sometimes it does change the way you offer your services. And so that the first one is income eligibility, but foster children being in foster care, children being in CPS, children with identified disabilities, and that in our program is defined by having an IEP. Although we'll support the referral process if they already have an IEP, that will increase their eligibility points.
Are you federally funded?
It is a federally funded program, but we do partnership with some state programs in order to provide as many full day options as possible, because it is a need of this community to have free or to low to no cost childcare for working adults. And while our half day programs are amazing in terms of, you know, giving children, you know, quality experiences, they're not the best match for working parents or parents trying to go to school. And we also do a home based program too. So,
thank you.
So my three words I would say are committed, family, and community. I work for the Willits Charter School. It's a public charter charters issued by Willits Unified School District. And our mission is to educate grades 6 through 12. Anyone can come to our school so long as they go within our district. And if they're from the out-of-district, they do come in if there's spots available. I describe the Willits Charter School as part of a larger community, though. I've worked in most middle schools and high schools in Mendocino County, and there's a huge group of committed people trying to educate our children. And I would include us in that team. And for me, education, yeah, we have the classroom, we have the curriculum, we have the teachers and the students, but as these ladies alluded to, it's about a family support system. And I think what makes Willits Charter School unique is our focus on family connections and family involvement in the child's education. And without that, I think the classroom itself is kind of hobbled and hamstrung. It's not as functional. So we do our best to involve the families and support services throughout the community to help our kids get their education. And I think in this day and age, it really is challenging for children to show up for school with the distractions and with the other enticements of what's in their world, along with the socioeconomic demographics in our community. So for me, I always think of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Until those basic needs are met, people usually can't focus on the next thing. And I think it's our job as educators and communities to help those basic needs be met so the kids can show up in their lives for education. And we've had a lot of interaction with Mendocino College and NCO, and I think that's that collaborative nature that serves children and families the best, is to break down those walls of divisions and budgets and say, what is our ultimate purpose here as community members and leaders in our community? And how do we step up for not just this segment of the family or the community, but how do we step up for the families that build a community?
So that leads me to the next question, which is, if we do think of it as a pathway and a community fabric that helps children and families succeed, how do you see yourself fitting in? What's your role, or what's the part you do, you're serving? And where have the partnerships really worked? Where have you been able to integrate and work with others? And where, so what, maybe one example of where something's really worked in terms of connections, and then where something, where it's feel like there's a divide, or it's you're not seeing that integration of services, or you're not seeing that partnership. You don't have to answer both of them formally, but just maybe one of you that has an example that's where something's work, or one of you where has an example where something's a challenge.
I'm immediately when I'm listening,
John.
Thank you. When I'm listening to John, I'm just like, it's always amazing to me how much we're all thinking about the same stuff. We're all thinking about, you know, how are we helping these children meet these academic needs with this understanding that there's so many stressors out there that are, you know, their kids are getting to school, families are not having the resources to put their children in positions where they're best capable of learning those things. You know, those basic needs aren't being met. And that's one of the things that in our program where we are constantly looking for resources and collaborations. And, you know, and I've seen it work really well and not well. I mean, I don't know, that's not real, real helpful. But, you know, I can tell success stories, like amazing success stories. I mean, I can think of one child that was in our program that came here, and was in a just horribly abusive situation, was not a legal resident. He was under 3 years old. The person taking care of him wasn't really his grandma. And really, by our standards, didn't have the rights to stay in the country, and they were trying to send him back. And, you know, we were able to work with mental health professionals, find voluntary services through CPS, able to get respite care for this not really grandma, you know, who's fostering the child, but not really because he's not really a legal resident. We were able to find ways to get him through this so that he could stay in our program full day instead of half day, so that the grandma who was stepping up to do this could take care of him. And it was one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. And then on the flip side of it, you know, I've watched, you know, mental health services be removed and become harder and harder to access in our communities, and the detriment to our families and the effect it's having on them can be heartbreaking. So
I think something kind of from the opposite end, because we're kind of in the idea of cradle of the grave, we're
I like it.
Not too. You never know. I've had some really, really older people in my classes, but let's hope not. Let's hope careers. Let's go for careers. Yes, it does. One of the problems that the community has right now for the college is that we basically our enrollment is too low. And what that means that I don't think a lot of people realize is that for every student that we don't get, or what they call a full-time effective, or I don't remember. Yeah, FTE. I can't remember the exact word.
Equivalent.
Thank you. I could not remember that word. For every student that we don't have, we lose a large amount of money. And while it may not seem that big of a deal, we lost, I think it's 50 students recently. Well, 50 students times $5,000 is a whole lot of stuff that the college can no longer provide. But it also means that we've got a problem somewhere in our pipeline where the students aren't getting to us for whatever reason. And the college has been trying to solve that problem. And one of the things that they're doing, and it's just started, so I can't say how effective it's going to be, but one of the things that they are doing is that they're trying to partner with the earlier education and trying to bring students in as early as possible. They're promising to do things like, we'll go to the high school and we'll do the testing there, because when you go into college, usually you do some reading and math testing just to place you appropriately so that, for example, if you need extra help, you can take the earlier classes before you get into the harder ones. And we'll do the testing there. We'll help you sign up, because college is really daunting to people. So if there's somebody who can hold your hand and help you get through that process, that helps a lot. I mean, I can tell you, I was the first person in my family to go to college. Nobody in my family had any idea what we were doing. I ended up going to a college. I probably could have gone anywhere I wanted, and I ended up going to a college because it was close by my house, and they gave me a lot of money. That was it. I didn't know what I was doing. And a lot of students don't, especially in a community like this. So when the college can reach out and try to make those connections with high school students, and even before high school, in February, some of the students from the Willits Elementary Charter School are actually going to come into my class to observe what it's like in a college classroom, to get them started thinking about it early. Because if you think about it as somewhere you're going to go, and if you think about this as a possibility, you're much more likely to make choices that will help you get there. So we'll see how it works, but it's something that we're trying to do, and hopefully in a few years somebody will be able to sit up here and tell you that it's been very effective.
When I think about collaborations and what's helped me do my work in the last 15 years, it's really the personal relationships that I was kind of blessed to develop, and that was with the Sheriff's Department, it was with Mendocino County Health and Human Services when I was a contractor. It's with juvenile probation, it's with the unified school districts, and everywhere I went as either an employee of a nonprofit, Mendocino County Youth Project, or as a private contractor, or as a fellow county worker, people were open to that personal connection, and they were welcoming the services. And for me, I think that's what really works in communities, especially a community this small and this intimate, that we can really develop these connections that are real. I grew up in Washington, D.C. It's really hard to make that smaller community happen in a very large city. And, you know, just like one size doesn't fit all in education, communities can respond differently. And I think that's a real benefit to Mendocino County, is that we know each other. And, you know, even a few people in this room, either by name on introduction or by face, I'd recognize. And, you know, I really encourage people to make those personal face-to-face, conversation-based connections with each other, because that's what's worked. Regardless of the position I was filling or the work I was doing at whatever site, I could draw in those relationships to support the family and the kids that I worked with. So those collaborations have been absolutely amazing, not only for my professional life, but for my personal life. I mean, that's, you know, most of my friends are our professional coworkers. Most of us don't have a whole lot of time for a separate social life. So, you know, I feed that social side of my life with the people that I meet in my work. As far as the barriers, really, I don't like to look at barriers. I don't like to look at them as a force to contend with. I like to assume they're not going to be there. And that, for me, has worked. I expect the best out of the people that are also serving families and kids. So when I call for an appointment, I expect to get it. When I knocked on a principal's door when I was a youth worker or a substance abuse counselor, I expected to be welcome into the office and to have a few minutes of their time. And I rarely experienced the other. And I think part of that is, like I said, you know, we carry, in my opinion, forward our intention of service, especially as leaders in the community. And I think if we come from that place, people feel it. That energy is in the room, and they make time. And I try to give that back in the same way as an administrator at the school. If a parent comes in, rarely do I not have time to have them in my office and sit down. I rarely ask them to schedule another appointment. If it's important enough for them to come into my office and to ask for my time, whether it's by phone or in person, I assume that's my responsibility as a community member, not just as administrator, to respond to that human being in front of me. And, you know, that's the modeling and the lessons that we teach our kids. That's the kind of parent and worker they're going to be when they grow up. And for me, that mentoring culture, it's lacking in many communities. And it's lacking in our own in some respects. You know, we like to make these divisions around professionalism and degrees and income. But when it comes face to face, I used to look at my father. My father was a wonderful man. But he spoke in a way that was divisive, but he acted in a way that was inclusive, if you know what I mean. So there was a contradiction in his life, and for me it's about bringing those things together. You know, my dad had a heart of gold, but oftentimes in private, amongst his family members, you know, he'd say things that weren't appropriate about other people or about classes of people or races of people. But then when I saw his actions in the world, he was open and he was giving and he was generous. So for me, I try to focus on the modeling, the actual, what does he do? And I'm just trying in my life and helping my grown kids to understand the power of that. You know, wow, you know, if my father had that effect on me and he had that other side that really wasn't right, you know, what would it be like if I, as a father and a community member, brought those things together and my words matched my actions? So I know that doesn't answer your question about barriers, but like I said, I think the more energy we give to the assumption that there's going to be a roadblock, that roadblock materializes right in front of us, and it's in how we communicate.
John, I think you guys work outside of the educational environment as far as, or the formal, as far as having mentorships in the community or helping kids get jobs with people.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you guys do that?
Yeah, it's a small program that's developing. We had 5 students placed last year. This year, we're hoping to have the equal amount. Again, it comes down to the students being open and ready and willing to take that risk. And I think some years are better than others.
We have an MOU with you.
Yeah. And we should get together on that.
We should.
You know, one of the successes last year was with a student of ours, an 11th grader, who was having a challenge academically. But you know, he was making it, but he needed that next step, that thing to draw him through his education, something to look forward to. And he really liked culinary arts and the kitchen. And so I approached a restaurant in Ukiah that, in my opinion, is one of the finer restaurants I've ever been to. And a number of people said that, well, they, you know, they're not going to take one of our kids. And so I made an appointment with the owner, and I sat down with them. I explained what our program was, and I explained to him that, you know, this is a young man that really, really could benefit your restaurant, but also this could benefit his life and his family's life. And I didn't want him washing dishes for 4 months. Would you take him on as an apprentice or as an intern and really work him through your kitchen from, of course, you started dishwashing. I had a restaurant. You know, you have to learn that station first. But then would you really work him through? And he said, absolutely. And he took him on. It was a, you know, a fourth quarter internship. He still works for him part-time. And, you know, this is a 17-year-old that was rolling sushi in an open kitchen for one of the best restaurants I've ever been to by the end of that apprenticeship. So, again, it was that personal connection and me not listening to the naysayers. You know, that'll never happen. Can't happen. They won't do it. You know, what's it hurt to go in thinking, hey, they might do it or they should do it? And not in a coercive way, but, you know, in a community building way, you know, helping them see the benefit to their restaurant as well as to this child and their family.
Which segues perfectly to the next question, which is, as you think about the students or the young children you're serving, what is success? What does it look like for you? What are you aiming for the people you serve?
Oh, okay. I'll start. You know, it's interesting. I've had to reflect on that question from a variety of different perspectives, and it's changed for me as my job has changed. You know, when I was a teacher, it would have been an easy answer. I just my big goal for them was for them to leave my program with an excitement and a love of learning. And it's not that it's changed so much, but it's broadened. You know, it's broadened into that I want not just the children to have that, but that I want to be offering classrooms to the community that promote that in general, that I want families to have it. So it's as my job has broadened, my scope of that has broadened. And because I think sometimes that... you know, I just think I think education is fun. I think, you know, I think there's so much amazing and wonderful things for people to learn, and not all education matches every kind of person, but especially in early education, I mean, what we're doing is figuring it out. We're teaching children how to figure out how to learn and how to ask questions, and we're teaching families how to support that, and, you know, being able to create environments and connections and community connections that inspire that is just, that's what I want to do and I want to see.
I think for me, it's a couple of things. One of which...
Can you hear her?
No, you need to...
Oh, I'm sorry. For me, it's a couple of things. One of which is, you had asked the question about barriers, and one of the barriers that I see, you talked about people's, you know, expecting to succeed. I find that many of the students come into my classroom here expecting nothing or very little. Which is strange to me because I actually taught in San Diego for several years before I moved here. And one of my favorite things about teaching community college is that you have people who, in your classroom for all different kinds of reasons, but they're all there because they want to be. You know, they have all kinds of options, including just going and getting a job or, you know, sitting like a bump on a log. They've got all kinds of things they could be doing, but they chose to come to class that day. And most of them are very excited about that and very involved, and they want to go somewhere or learn something. But up here, one of the things that shocked me when I started teaching was how little my students expected. And not all of them. Some of them have great expectations, but many of them don't. And many of them don't have the confidence to, for example, ask a question when they don't understand or are not sure what to, you know, or want to learn more. And so for me, part of that success is convincing my students that my classroom, but also the world, is a friendly place where you are welcome to ask questions, you are welcome to engage, and where you should have expectations and you should expect to succeed. And part of my part in that is walking in and telling them, these are the things that I expect of you. And these are the things that I'm going to offer you in my classroom. This is going to be a safe space. If you have a question, ask it. I will answer it. If you want to share an experience, this is a safe area for it to be, you to share it. And I will make sure that that's true. I find that when those things are offered and really followed through with, a lot of students begin to develop that confidence. And when I can see that, when I see my students, people who never talk, suddenly raise their hand and express an opinion, maybe one that's even a little bit different from what the rest of the class has said, that's wonderful. Because every time that they do it, it makes them a little bit stronger and a little bit more confident. And it means that next time out in the world, they might be willing to do the same thing. The other thing that I see that's something of a barrier, probably much more than something of a barrier, many of the students in my classes don't have basic skills necessary to succeed in college. They just don't. And I say that in San Diego, it was something we complained about. And when people started complaining about it up here, I went, oh, yeah, everybody says that. And then I walked into my first classroom and I went, oh, this is a little more than what I'm used to. And so part of that for me was having to change my expectations of not, okay, your paper is due on this day, but this is how we're going to write the paper. And when I have a student who comes to me and says, I've never written a research paper before, I don't think I can do this. And at the end of the class turns in a research paper, it's not that they turned in a paper and got a grade. They learned a skill, not so much writing a paper, but writing at all. Doing research and having the confidence to follow through with something they thought they couldn't do. And I think that that's really, really, really important. And for me, is what I would call success and makes me feel that I've done really well with my job. And it doesn't always happen, but when it does, it's really, really wonderful.
Kind of going off of that subject, talking about skills, you know, one of the number one issues that employers have is that the next generation doesn't have the skills necessary to even do a job. And it seems, for me growing up and going to college, because that's what you did after high school, there's such a push on doing that and learning how to pass tests so you can move on to the next class, so you can move on to college, so you can do all this, that, and the other, which will ultimately land you a good job, will make some money, and you'll be able to have a family, et cetera, et cetera. But it seems like we're lacking in the skill building aspect of education, and this push of getting people on to higher education, four-year universities, et cetera. What about all the vocational stuff? I mean, that's why I love community college, because there's so many more options and certifications that you can actually go and apply and use for a job. But, I mean, in terms of like the whole pipeline from young age to high school to community college, is there ever going to be a transition away from, let's just move you through so you can graduate, so you can go to college and you can land jobs sometime down the road, in terms of, let's actually get people who have skills that they can then take out to the real world and actually apply, instead of saturating the job market like we're seeing of all these people who go to college because that's what they're told that they need to do, and they end up with a psychology degree and working at Starbucks.
John, do you have go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I don't know, I'm guessing, I could be wrong about this, but just given your certifications, I think I'm probably the youngest person here. And I have huge college debt. My husband has huge college debt. And for us, it's kind of okay. It's worked out. We had a lot of scholarships. But I know a lot of people that it hasn't worked out for. And I'm sure you've all heard, they talk about it on NPR all the time, the burgeoning college debt that is killing us. And so my younger sister is engaged to a gentleman who's going to be, well, he is a lawyer. He got out of college. It took him forever to get a job. Mind you, he went to Vanderbilt, was excellent, did great. It took him forever to get a job because there's too many lawyers. And he's been told his entire life that if he does these things, he'll succeed, everything will be great. Instead, he's got this huge debt. He had a hard time getting a job, and he's not doing what he wants to do, and he's getting paid way less. He can't even pay more than the interest on his loans. And he was incredibly frustrated and incredibly disappointed. And it's the feeling of people I talk to, especially my generation, that we're not going to tell our kids the same thing. I'm not going to tell my son that he has to go to college if he wants to get a good job. I'm going to tell my son, if you want to be a doctor, a lawyer, if you have a passion for it, then yes, go to college. If not, go to a community college. Become a plumber. We think of plumbers as a dirty job. Plumbers make a lot of money. We need plumbers. In fact, there aren't enough of them up here.
And they can't be outsourced.
Yeah. We need them.
Not that much plumbing work. Okay.
John, really, the charter school perspective, or from the high school perspective, or 6-12, what's your feeling on that subject, or how have you gone about tackling that question?
You know, I'm really not a traditional administrator, and I probably rub people the wrong way sometimes when I talk about youth development and what I'd like to see for kids. But I'd love to see a paradigm shift from the emphasis on income to an emphasis on meaning. And when I have my conversations with students about what their path is going to be, and again, I'm not saying it's an easier path. In fact, sometimes it's more difficult. But I always encourage them to, you know, don't chase the money, chase the meaning. and live within those means, because that's what's going to serve us and our families. You know, I mean, I know that we all have stories either in our own family or people that we've heard about or know. I'll think of my uncle who spent, you know, 35 years doing a job he hated to retire, to sail around the world. By the end, he was physically and emotionally incapable of following that dream. And he died within 3 years of retirement of stress-related illnesses that developed in chasing that dream. But, you know, so for me, you know, I'd really like to see us as communities value the dreaming of the kids, you know, and encouraging them wherever their passion is. You know, because those passions change. I mean, I never wanted to set foot in another school after my second high school. My third high school inspired me, a teacher in particular, and made me want to go to college. I went to college right out of high school, out of my third one. I wasn't prepared. I didn't learn the study skills or the academics, but I was smart. But I had other challenges, those Maslow's needs, and I spent 3 semesters at University of Maryland and failed out miserably. I went into the military, good, bad, or indifferent. Came out and went back to school. I was ready. I was motivated. And for me, I guess what success is when I see a shift in the students from that extrinsic motivational factors to the intrinsic. That's when we've succeeded with a kid, because, you know, I've worked with probation. I've worked with you know, disciplinary policies in our school and rules and consequences at home, working with families. And those are all extrinsic. It's like, how do we corral this child into compliance? And, you know, on some level, for safety and for whatever reason, social reasons, we need to do that on some level. But when I see a shift from a kid that says, you know, John, you know what I'm thinking about doing? Wow, what are you thinking about doing? That's great. And for me, it could be just as beneficial to graduate high school, buy a good pair of hiking boots and a backpack, and hit the road in Europe for a year. You know, I have friends and relatives that have done that, and it's inspired them, and it's led to other things, and they're as successful or more successful than most people I know. But it's not the traditional path. And so for me to spend that fortune on private school or university because it's what's supposed to happen, I think it's a disservice to kids. I think it does interrupt that lifelong learning cycle, because then I would imagine people get out of college and say, I'll never set foot in another college again, because it was this extrinsic force. You know, this is what I'm supposed to do. And, you know, I come from a family that's had some hardships around that, where people in my family have given up and left the planet because they weren't supported in the dream direction and they couldn't handle the other one. So for me, I look at every family and every kid as, you know, what are they looking for? And, you know, there are no guaranteed formulas for success. You know, there aren't. You know, there may have been a very high percentage chance if you got a 4-year degree, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, you're dialed. You know, you went to a company, you know, General Electric or Ford, and you stayed with them for 30, 40 years, and you know, had a golden parachute pension plan. That's not happening anymore. And the average person, I think, changes jobs or careers 8 to 10 times in their lifetime. And if we don't kind of prepare kids in a positive way to accept that, you know, I'm on my, I don't know what career. But that's what I do. And it's not because, you know, I can't continue in what I'm doing. It's because I want to be in control of that future. And I want to live as many lives in a productive, community-based way as I can. Not everybody's into that. But just like people in my life, like my mom, have supported me in my dreaming, that's what kept me going. You know, I was about to open up a restaurant, and the opportunity came, and the opening day was 3 weeks later, which is breaking every rule. And I had a lot of people in my life saying, John, you're crazy. Why would you do that? You're going to fail. And at one point, about a week and a half into it, I, you know, called my mom, I always do, and told her, you know, I don't think I'm going to do this. And she goes, Johnny, what are you doing? And I said, you know, people are just telling me I'm crazy, you know. I haven't met with another restaurateur. I've never run a restaurant, this and that. And she told me something that I'll never forget. And she said, you know, Johnny, there's enough people in the world. They're a dime a dozen. They're going to ant on your dreams every day. Surround yourself with people that support you, that believe in you, even if they don't understand what you're doing. And that's what I did. We were open 3 years. We're breaking even at 3 years. That's ahead of the curve. We decided to close. We were done and we wanted to live another dream. That's when we came to Willits. So, you know, for me, success is that, you know, when do those kids and the families start supporting that child's dream? And we don't always understand it. You know, I'll tell every teenager I work with, I have no idea what it's like to be a teenager in 2014 in Willits, California, period. And nobody in this room does. You know, and if we don't live with that kind of knowledge that we don't know what it's like for them, then we tend to tell them what's best for us, not what's best for them.
So if you go ahead.
You know, I'm just going to add something, though, to that skill building question that you added, because it's something that in my position, I deal with a lot, because my job is to train the teachers, and that's including the aides that come in, you know, out of high school. They don't have to have any prior experience, the associate teachers and the teachers, with these continuously increasing requirements around what kind of experiences they're providing. And it's one of the things that I notice is our challenge is, like, how to create these higher quality coaching and mentoring experiences. And basically our program is having to do it on their own. So even with a college degree, they're often coming to us without that experience, without that coaching or that internship. And so now we are having to facilitate making that happen within our own program. So that's how we're dealing with it.
So if you could change one concrete thing today, flip a switch and change it in the educational pipeline in this community, what would it be and why? The one thing you think would make a big difference for the students here, young people here.
I thought about this for a long time, because trying to say one thing, one concrete thing, is really difficult. And one thing that I could come up with, and I'm sure there are a lot of other answers and probably better ones, but the one that I came up with last night was, there is so little technology here in comparison to San Diego. And I don't mean to suggest that technology is the answer to everything at all. Please, I'm a historian. I don't mean to suggest that technology is the solution to everything. But I do think that in the world that we live in today, I ask my students when they come into class, how many of you have access to internet? I was shocked when I realized that over half my class didn't have access, and those who did, majority was on their phones. Now, don't get me wrong, I love my phone, I use it all the time. But if you're trying to, for example, write a paper, trying to convince my students to go visit the library and that it exists and that it's a brick and mortar building is very difficult. Most of them have never been there. And this was true in San Diego, too. They tend to do things technologically, and that's okay. But they need to have access to that technology in a concrete way that's easily accessible. And so many of our students don't. And that, in a lot of ways, puts them behind, not just educationally, but job skills-wise as well. You know, if you've never written a business letter don't know how to go to Google and look it up and figure, that's a problem. All kinds of issues like that. And so I really do think that technology is one of the solutions. I don't think it's the only solution or even maybe the best one, but I definitely think it's one of them.
Broadband Alliance of Mendocino County. Broadband Alliance of Mendocino County. Look it up, attend a meeting, give a testimonial.
And bring it to the South Coast.
But if you're on the wrong side of the hill, you know.
Folks, some of us are members, and we're trying, we got it, and we're trying so hard.
Yeah. Thank you.
What about the other side of that? Do you have 50% of the people that don't have internet? Because they don't want the internet?
No, yeah. A lot of them, they can't get it or can't afford it.
There's a large group of people in this county who don't want the internet, don't want that access,
I think that's
don't
changing.
Want smart things.
I think it's changing. I really do. I think that a lot of those people have really gotten a lot of, I don't do that as much.
Well, don't take me wrong. We sell internet stuff all day long. All day long. And then some.
I think a lot of people realize it's not just a huge impact on education, which it is, but it's a huge impact on their economy. Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter. Folks who don't want it, stand at the end of your road, don't get it. The rest of us who want prescriptions, who want to teach our kids, who want to rent movies, who want to communicate with our best friend in Rome. Yeah.
sorry.
So other
I'm sorry, just
wanted
to chime in just one second.
Of course.
The other end of that is like I know Linda is in Walla and she wants, you know, for her business and she owns a business, she wants people on the internet looking up her stuff. But where I'm at, it's mostly retired people. And so it's not just individual choices. There are whole communities here who don't want it. And so although in the more populated areas, you're probably right, there's probably more people heading towards that. But in the communities that are more retirement communities, where you have small schools and not a lot of kids, those kids are going to have a harder time getting it because their grandparents or their parents don't want it.
John or Robin, things that you would change, one or two things you...
Yeah, honestly, the thing that I wrote down was of what we just talked about, that we need more quality coaching and internship opportunities for the people coming into careers, especially in education careers and early education in this community. They often come to us with the classes and no internship experience.
So is that education for the adults that are educating?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm thinking of two things, and one is something we're trying to do at the charter school, which is building skills, life skills, not just the academic skills, which I think are very important, but our culinary arts program, teaching kids to be adept in a kitchen. I mean, that's a life skill that keeps giving all the time. To home economics, you know, it's been something that's been kind of gutted from our educational system, except for in wealthy districts. They still teach finance, personal finance, and, you know, how to take care of a home and how to open up a checking account. We're trying to initiate that more and more with our kids. For me, it's really about developing that student that's ready to engage in their life. And to do that, they need to be able to create a household, to not be dependent on fast foods and convenience foods, to not, you know, have to hire out for everything. You know, my father taught me one thing, and it was, Johnny, do this. And didn't give me a lot of direction, but it taught me that I could learn. And if the kids come out ready to learn and having the confidence that they can learn what's put in front of them, I think that's a powerful thing. The second thing that I think is really underpinning everything we need is funding. There is no way our county, especially Willits, is coming out of their educational budget crisis by themselves, not without gutting beyond bone. And it's not a local solution, and I know what some people think it is, but I don't think you can cut enough to dig out of this hole, and I don't think it's our fault. I've got relatives that live in communities where the kids are funded almost $20,000 per child. We get, you know, at Willits Charter, just a little over $6,000 per child. And we do the best we can with that, but I'm constantly forced to make these Sophie choices of whether I have more aides or whether I have another full-time teacher or whether we can afford yard duty, an extra person to come in and watch our kids and you know, or can we afford an aide for every teacher? You know, boy, if I had my way, there'd be co-teaching in every classroom. So we have two credentialed teachers in every classroom in some districts, you know, nationally in really well-funded private schools or well-funded, you know, wonderful tax-based communities. They do that. You know, they have at least the equivalent. They have very, very talented people, and we do too, but we don't have enough of them. And so when a teacher's out on long-term, we get a substitute in that can't really carry the curriculum. We have teachers that are overworked. I have my teachers, you know, I'll drive by. I'm a family person, and I will give so much before I need to give back to my families, but I'll drive by my school on the way back from taking my wife out and see two or three teachers' cars in the parking lot 3 days a week trying to get ready for the next day. And they're committed, but they're overworked, and they're working with limited resources. You know, technology, absolutely. You know, we can do wonderful things with that. But to do it and maintain it, to do it and have the tech support and the instruction for the teachers to use it effectively, because I'll tell you right now, if you don't have a systems person that's maintaining that system, confidence drops in the system, and teachers adjust to the expectation that they're not going to put 3 hours into a lesson plan if that projector's not going to work, if that PowerPoint's not going to show up, if the internet's going to collapse on them. They're not going to do it. So it's almost like, you know, window dressing. It's not really being used properly. So I think funding is absolutely key, and I think it's a national issue. And if you want to get into that politics, I don't think this is the venue, because I will get very upset.
And I kind of purposely left that off my
hand. So one last prepared question, and then we'll have a few minutes for some group questions. Thinking about the next 5 years, what is the dream or the wish that you hope could come true for the education system in this community? What is that kind of 5-year goal or dream?
For what I see, the two things that come to mind and that I wrote down were just more and more collaboration between the agencies within our community. I think that's one of the keys to making some of the things and some of the resources that are necessary available. That, and then just what did I write? For teachers to feel more supported and valued in our communities in relationship to the level of work and responsibility that they've been given. That would be my...
I would have to go back to what I said before. I want to see more students come into my classroom with more of the basic skills that they need and more of the confidence that they're there and they can succeed. And if something's a little bit challenging, that's okay. It's just something challenging that they can learn and succeed at. And I think that's entirely possible. But I also think it takes a lot of work and a lot of time and a lot of collaboration between agencies.
I'm relocating, and I hope to come back in the next 5 years. And what I'd like to see is a well-funded school system where teachers and administrators can focus on the purpose of their work and not on, you know, the crumbs on the floor and what we're going to do with them, how we're going to divvy them up. For me, it's heartbreaking. I was at the school board meeting. We were presenting our annual report to the district. And, you know, one of my friends who's a teacher at one of our schools made a heartfelt speech about collaboration and about, and he was directing it towards not only the charter school, but also towards the school board and towards the administration and, for all of us to really remember why we're here and why we chose that professional field. And for me, it's back to following your dreams. And I always encourage people, if that's not their dream and they're just in there pulling a check, please leave and find something that you're passionate about, because we're fighting when we should be caring for the kids. So I'd like to see a fully funded school system where we're not counting enrollment dollars, which I know the college has to do, and I know that we have to pay attention to. But, you know, in my opinion, myself, along with other people within the school districts that I work with, when we talk about school placement, I take that administrator hat off. I know they do too. And we find the best place for that student, regardless of whether it takes something from my enrollment or theirs. And I believe in that. And I think the more we don't have to worry and bicker about the money, and it's literally, we're down to dollars. Literally dollars people are scrambling for. I think that would be a huge benefit to our kids, our family, and our community, because communities grow with the school system. And some people disagree with me, but when families come in, especially young families that have a lot of earning potential in their lives yet to have, they look for schools for their kids. And if they step into our community and read our newspapers and check our, the status, the pulse of our school system, and see bickering and funding problems, they move on to the next community and they look for another town. It's very, very important to young families where their kids go to school. So if we want to grow our community, the economy, the economic potential in Mendocino County, especially in the waning years of our marijuana industry, which it is, it may always be here, but it's not what it was. We have to grow this economy in a way that supports young families. And to do that, like I said, the school system has to be solid and unquestionably funded with integrity for the kids.
I'm glad you brought up that point. I have four kids right now. Our fifth one's coming in April. They're all under six. And I'm glad you brought up the point of whether or not that bickering can be solved. Because I know a lot of other parents of young children my age are seriously considering homeschooling a lot more.
Yeah.
And just throwing out the topic there, because it seems like the nice thing is that you guys all represent kind of a different stream of the education. I mean, we don't have somebody specifically from like the mainstream public education system. You know, you're all different avenues that I believe in. But from the traditional schooling standpoint, it's scary to start putting your young kids through that system. And I have seen from my own little circle of a lot more people considering homeschooling. What are your takes on that?
Just briefly, I substitute taught before I started teaching for the college because we moved up here for a job for my husband, so I left my job and before I was invited to teach for the college. I substitute taught for a while, and I got to see a lot of the different schools in the not just Willits, but also Ukiah, because I taught for both. I didn't get to sub for the charter, but I know some people who go to some of the charter schools and are really happy with them. And what amazed me was the difference from school to school. There are schools that if people ask me, I say, I wouldn't send my son there. And there are schools that you know, I'll check them out in a couple years when my son's ready to go to school, but that I was really impressed with. And so I would say I went through the public system. I was in San Diego. I felt I got a good education. I felt that it really depended on the teacher and the involvement of the parent and the involvement of the student. But I do think that there are good schools here. I think you just have to look out and see and visit the school and be involved with your children's education. You can't ever, I don't believe you can ever rely entirely on the school to educate your child. I think that's as much a parent's responsibility as it is the school's.
Well,
but that's just my personal opinion. Yeah. If that's a possibility for you, that's great. There's also the need for interaction and things, which I think are good. But I'm just saying, I think there are good public schools available also if you look for them.
Mm-hmm. I think that you make a wonderful point, because that's one of the things that where we're really bringing our focus back on our parents again, you know, and we talk a lot about the achievement gap in our program. And, you know, we know that a lot of our parents don't have that option, you know, and I will say as a parent, I did the same thing. I ended up looking at homeschool. I almost homeschooled my kid. I almost gave up my job to homeschool my kid. Thankfully, the charter school was there. So, and he loved it. So, but you know, the more you're involved as a parent, the more that you understand the impact that your time that you spend with your child, whether it be 20 minutes a day or an hour a day, the more you understand what that is, how it affects their education, the more you understand how you can communicate effectively with schools and teachers and what you can ask for, the more you can play that role. And also, you know, advocacy in general on a bigger level, whether it be that you know participate in school events, you know, those kinds of things make a difference. And that's one of the things that we've been working on, like parent trainings and parent education sessions. We're getting more and more passionate about that, because we see it's really almost as big of a part of how helping our children have a head start as the actual experiences that our teachers are providing to the children. So
we want to make sure we're staying on schedule and want to honor your time. What we're going to do right now is just give you a chance to say any last little thoughts that you have, and then take a 10-minute break, and then we're going to continue this conversation in a kind of a case study style way. Although I don't think you can stay
till
2:30. Okay. So anything that we didn't cover that was in kind of your thoughts as you were thinking about this pipeline panel, or if there's any kind of closing remarks to the panel you want to make, things that we should walk away thinking about. I mean, to the group that you want to make, if any.
I think obviously there's a reason to take this Leadership Mendocino course, and I'm assuming that people are engaged and want to really add to our community here. And I encourage you to look for ways to interface with the schools. And Willits Charter School is a public school. It's a public charter. And a lot of people get confused because there's a lot of for-profit charters, and they're very different. You know, we don't require tuition. We don't turn anybody away. If there's a spot, they got it. So we're part of the public school system, but yet we're not held to all the education codes. So that allows us to be kind of an incubator of new ideas. So we can take things and run with them in the classroom and on a school-wide basis that then the larger systems, which have a little harder time adjusting and turning back if something's not working, can you know, see what we're doing and maybe, okay, that's working, we'll try that. And I've seen that in our schools. Like I said, I've worked in all these schools, and I've seen them adopt some of the things that the charter school has done in the last 13, 14 years. And for me, like I said, whether you have kids in the school system or not, the adults in the community, whatever your skill is, please approach an administrator, approach a school site, and see whether there's something that, you could offer. And sometimes the timing's just not right, and people will get turned away. But keep coming back, because we need the adults to help mentor these kids. And this is no disrespect to any families that, I've worked with or know, but oftentimes the families, for one reason or another, can't show up in that way. And, you know, it really takes all of us to, role model for these kids, whether it's on the street, in the park, in the theater. I mean, just being solid adults in kids' lives, you know, in youth development, there's kind of a little adage, you know, it takes one individual, it takes one person to make a genuine, authentic connection with a, young person that could change their life. And I was fortunate, I could count three, you know. I could count my drill sergeant, I could count Clive Adams, who I first moved out and lived with out at Emmendale when I came to Willits, and I can think of my father. And they all had different strengths, and I had to kind of pull the best from each one. But without them, oh, excuse me, Miss Smith, ninth grade. I was probably the most challenging middle school and high school student you'll ever meet. No student that I've ever worked with ever hits my point of challenge in the classroom or in the school or in the community, I promise you. And she spun a negative into a positive. We were at a parent night in her health class, and she gave me a little reward, a little award for the most knowledgeable, because I would share what I knew, but she didn't share that part, you know, she wouldn't share that part. She had me stand up and gave me an authentic appreciation, and it was one of the few I got in school. And in another assembly, I helped Mr. McLeese, who was a social studies teacher that I tormented. And he asked me one weekend to help him move some wrestling mats across town. And I helped him. And 3 weeks later, he gives me a citizenship pin at an all-school assembly. Never forget it. Mm-hmm. And in my true form, as they were announcing, you know, so-and-so's going to get this award, I'd stand up for everyone. Oh, yeah. You know, and play that clown. And I did it for that one, and my name came up. And I immediately went, you know, and it touched me, and I'll never forget that. So little interactions with young people. One of my first jobs was an outreach worker for the Youth Project, and I had to basically kind of investigate the park and find homeless kids and out-of-school kids and try to help them back into school. And I spent the first 3 days before my job started just sitting on a bench looking, and I watched group after group, individual after individual of adults take the long road around groups of teenagers. They wouldn't interact. They wouldn't walk past them close enough to hear them. They didn't want to take the risk of just saying hello. And so I decided that if I was going to start this kind of work in my community, that's where I'd start. And I walked up to these circles, and I'd sit down with them, and they go, "Who is this?" You know, I tell them so they weren't scared of me. You know, I work for somebody. Don't worry. You know, who, you know, anyway, you get my point. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to the amazing educators we have here. Thank you.